You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 17th. I'm Tom from Jake University. Here's our first story. Terminally ill, appeal for access to assisted death. 12 states consider legislation dealing with end of life amid patchwork of laws. Courtesy of Jesse Vidan for the Associated Press. On a brisk day at a restaurant outside Chicago, Deb Robertson sat with her teenage grandson to talk about her death. She'll probably miss his high school graduation. Death doesn't frighten her much. The 65-year-old didn't cry when she learned 2 months ago that the cancerous tumors in her liver were spreading, portending a tormented death. But later, she receives a call. A bill moving through the Illinois legislature to allow certain terminally ill patients to end their lives with a doctor's help had made progress. Then she cried. Medical aid in dying is not me choosing to die, she said she told her 17-year-old grandson. I'm going to die, but it is my way of having a little bit more control over what it looks like in the end. That same conversation is happening beside hospital beds and around dinner tables across the country, as Americans who are nearing life's end negotiate with the terms with themselves, their families, and now state lawmakers. At least 12 states currently have bills that would legalize physician-assisted death. 8 states and Washington, D.C. already allow it, but only for their own residents. Vermont and Oregon permit any qualifying American to travel to their state for the practice. Patients must be at least 18 years old, within 6 months of death, and be assessed to ensure they are capable of making an informed decision. 2 states have gone in the opposite direction. Kansas has a bill to further criminalize those who help someone with their physician-assisted death. West Virginia is asking voters to enshrine its current ban into the state constitution. That patchwork of laws has left Americans in most states without recourse. Some patients choose to apply for residency in a state where it's legal. Others take arduous trips into the late stage of disease to die in unfamiliar places and beds, far from family, friends, and pets. It was late at night when Rod Azam awoke to his wife crawling on the floor screaming. Pain from her cancer had punched through the heavy morphine dose. Let me die, screamed his wife Susan. As Rod rushed to hold her, the cries faded to repeated mumbles. Heaven, she said, again and again. Susan, 68, pieced through her life's belongings. Family heirlooms, photos, an antique spinning wheel, touching the memories a final time. Then she decided where the next lives would be. She said goodbye to her constant sidekick, Sunny, a fluffy Maltipoo. Then the couple traveled to Oregon. The issue is contentious. Opponents have moral objections with the very concept of someone ending their life. Even with safeguards in place, they argue, the decision could be made for the wrong reasons, including depression or pressure from family burden with their caretaking. It's normalizing suicide and it's incentivizing individuals to end their lives, said Danielle Pimentel of Americans United for Life. Pimentel raised concerns that pain isn't the top reason people choose an early departure, adding that policy should focus on bettering end-of-life care. 2 national organizations lobbying for the bills argue it's about autonomy and compassion, some power over one's preordained exit. It comes down to the right of an individual to control their own end-of-life decisions, free from government intervention or religious interference, said Jeff Sugerman, national campaign strategist, Death with Dignity. Even though it's illegal in most states, a 2018 Gallup poll showed more than 2/3 of Americans support the practice. Only a small fraction of Americans across the country, about 8,700, have used physician-assisted death since Oregon became the first state to legalize it in 1997, according to the advocacy group Compassion and Choices. The organization successfully sued Oregon and Vermont over their residency requirements in the past 2 years and are using the courts to expand access. California has a bill before lawmakers that would allow out-of-staters to access the procedure. 3 states, including Colorado, have proposals to expand in-state access, such as allowing advanced practice registered nurses, not just doctors, to prescribe the medication. As Robinson discussed with the topic with her grandson, he got teary-eyed. If it became legal in Illinois tonight, would his grandmother be gone tomorrow? How does that differ from suicides that left empty seats at his school? Robertson reassured him that it would be the very last option as she embarks on a new chemotherapy treatment. Then she explained the safeguards. Typically, two doctors must confirm that a patient has 6 months to live. The patient must verbally request it twice with a waiting period that varies by state and submit a written request with witnesses. At three meetings, a physician assesses the patient to ensure they are able to make an informed decision. The patient can be referred to a psychologist for an assessment if there are concerns. Patients must take the medication themselves. They lose consciousness within a few minutes and die usually within a few hours. Eventually, the teenager met her eyes. "Granny, I support whatever you choose to do," he said. When Gary Drake, a jovial businessman from Florida, received a diagnosis that lung, bone, and kidney cancer would end his life within 6 months, he didn't deliberate long. The 78-year-old flew to Oregon in February, after beginning a Facebook post with RIP. "I love you all, say a prayer for me, and I'll see you on the other side," the February 13th post read. His son Mitch flew to Oregon to meet with his father. They said their goodbyes, then Drake drank the medicine. As they played in his song request, Toes by Zac Brown Band, Drake put the cup down and sang, "Life is good today, life is good today." Then he fell asleep. Our next story starts with court questions charges against participants. Ruling expected this summer could have broader repercussions, courtesy of Mark Sherman of the Associated Press. From Washington, the Supreme Court questioned Tuesday whether federal prosecutors went too far in bringing obstruction charges against hundreds of participants in the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. It wasn't clear how the justices would rule in a case that could also affect the prosecution of former President Donald Trump, who faces the same charge in his efforts to overturn his election loss in 2020. The justices heard arguments over the charge of obstruction of an official proceeding the case of Joseph Fisher, a former Pennsylvania police officer who was indicted for his role in disrupting Congress's certification of Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election win over Trump. Fisher is one of 330 people facing that charge, which stems from a law passed in the aftermath of the Enron financial scandal more than two decades ago to deal with the destruction of documents. A decision is expected by late June. Trump faced two charges in a separate case brought by special counsel Jack Smith in Washington that could be knocked out with a favorable ruling from the nation's highest court. Next week, the justices will hear arguments over whether the former president and presumptive nominee for the 2024 Republican nomination has absolute immunity from prosecution in that case, a proposition that was so far was rejected by two lower courts. Smith argued separately in the immunity case that the obstruction charges against Trump are valid no matter how the court decides Fisher's case. The first former U.S. president under indictment, Trump, is on trial on hush money charges in New York and also has been charged with election interference in Georgia and with mishandling classified documents in Florida. It was not clear after more than 90 minutes of arguments whether the court would land on Fisher's case. Conservative Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch appeared most likely to side with Fisher, while liberal justices Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor seemed more favorable to the Justice Department's position. Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson, a former federal public defender, expressed interest in more of a middle ground outcome that might make it harder, but not impossible, for prosecutors to use the obstruction charge. Some conservative justices said that the law was so broad that it could be used against even peaceful protests and also questioned why the Justice Department has not brought charges under the provision in other violent protests. "There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings," Justice Clarence Thomas said. He was back on the bench Tuesday after an unexplained one-day absence. Gorsuch appeared to be drawing on actual events when he asked Solicitor General Elizabeth Prolegar whether people could be charged with obstructing an official proceeding if they rose in protest inside the courtroom, heckled the president at the State of the Union, or pulled a fire alarm in the Capitol complex to delay a vote in Congress. Alito, suggesting the government's reading of the law is too broad, asked whether the charge could be applied to people who disrupted the day's court session by shouting, "Keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail," or "Free the January 6th patriots." He hastened to add, "What happened on January 6th was very, very serious, and I'm not equating this with that." The High Court case focuses on whether the anti-obstruction provision of a law that was enacted in 2002 in response to the financial scandal that brought down Enron Corporation can be used against January 6th defendants. Lawyers for Fisher, the former North Cornwall Township police officer, argued that the provision was meant to close a loophole in criminal law and discourage the destruction of records in response to an investigation. Until the Capitol riot, lawyer Jeffrey Green told the court on Fisher's behalf the provision had never been used to prosecute anything other than evidence tampering. But Prelogar, the administration's top Supreme Court lawyer, said that the other side is reading the law too narrowly, arguing it serves as a classic catch-all designed to deal with the obstruction of an official proceeding. She said Fisher's actions before, during, and after January 6th demonstrated that he intended to keep Congress from doing its job of certifying the election results. He had said in advance of January 6th that he was prepared to storm the Capitol, prepared to use violence. He wanted to intimidate Congress, Prelogar said. He said, "They can't vote if they can't breathe." And then he went with the Capitol on January 6th with that intent in mind and took action, including assaulting a law enforcement officer. The obstruction charge is among the most widely used felony charges brought in the massive federal prosecution following the violent insurrection. It carries a maximum prison term of 20 years, but Prelogar said the average term imposed so far is about 2 years. About 170 January 6 defendants have been convicted of obstructing or conspiring to obstruct the January 6 joint session of Congress, including the leaders of two far-right extremist groups, the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers. Some defendants had their sentencings delayed until after the justices rule on the matter. Some rioters even won early release from prison while the appeal is pending over concerns that they might end up serving longer than they should have if the Supreme Court rules against the Justice Department. More than 1,350 people have been charged with Capitol riot-related federal crimes. About 1,000 of them pleaded guilty or were convicted. On to our next story. Your coffee may be more than 500,000 years old, courtesy of the Associated Press. There's a picture on the middle of the article here. Mohamed Fita picks coffee beans on his farm about 235 southwest of Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, on September 21st, 2002. Depicts a man picking red coffee beans off of a coffee plant. That coffee you sipped, or slurped, this morning, it's 600,000 years old. Using genes from coffee plants around the world, researchers built a family tree of the world's most popular type of coffee, known to scientists as Coffea arabica and to coffee lovers simply as Arabica. The researchers, hoping to learn more about the plants to better protect them from pests and climate change, found that the species emerged around 600,000 years ago through natural crossbreeding of two other coffee species. In other words, prior to any intervention from man, said Victor Albert, a biologist at the University of Buffalo who co-led the study. These wild coffee plants originate in Ethiopia, but are thought to have first roasted and brewed primarily in Yemen starting in the 1400s. In the 1600s, Indian monk Baba Budan is fabled to have smuggled 7 raw coffee beans back to his homeland from Yemen, laying the foundation for coffee's global takeover. Arabica coffee, prized for its smooth and relatively sweet flavor, now makes up 60 to 70% of the global coffee market and is brewed by brands such as Starbucks, Tim Hortons, and Dunkin'. The rest is Robusta, a stronger and more bitter coffee made from one of Arabica's parents, Coffea caffeinora. To piece together Arabica coffee's past, researchers studied genomes of C. canephora, another parent called Coffea eugenes, and more than 30 Arabica plants, including a sample from the 1700s, courtesy of the National History Museum of London, that Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus used to name the plant. The study was published Monday in the journal Nature Genetics. Researchers from Nestle, which owns several coffee brands, contributed to the study. The Arabica plant's population fluctuated over thousands of years before humans began cultivating it, flourishing during warm, wet periods and suffering through dry ones. These lean times created so-called population bottlenecks, when only a small number of genetically similar plants survived. Today, that renders Arabica coffee plants more vulnerable to diseases like coffee leaf rust, which causes billions of dollars in losses every year. The researchers explored the makeup of one Arabica variety that is resistant to coffee leaf rust, highlighting sections of its genetic code that could help protect the plant. The study clarifies how Arabica came to be and spotlights clues that could help safeguard the crop, said Fabian Escriveria, an advisor for the Center of Coffee Research and Education at Texas A&M University, who is not involved in the research. Exploring Arabica's past and present could yield insight into keeping coffee plants healthy and coffee cups full for future early mornings. And now for today's digest. Powell, Federal Reserve may delay cuts to rates. From Washington, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell cautioned Tuesday that persistently elevated inflation likely will delay any interest rate cuts until later this year. Recent data have clearly not given us greater confidence that inflation is coming fully under control and instead indicate that it's likely to take longer than expected to achieve that confidence, Powell said during a panel discussion at the Wilson Center. If higher inflation does persist, he said, we can maintain the current level of interest rates for as long as needed. His comments also suggested the central bank may make fewer than the 3/4-point reductions in its official forecast at their March meeting. The Fed's rate is at a 23-year high of 5.3% after 11 rate hikes that began 2 years ago. Strong storms spawned tornadoes in two states, from St. Louis. Strong storms caused damage in parts of the central U.S. Tuesday and spawned tornadoes in Kansas and Iowa. An EF1 tornado touched down shortly after 6 a.m. near Richland, Texas, the National Weather Service said. It reached speeds of up to 100 miles an hour and was on the ground for about 20 minutes, the service said. Two people were injured when their RV flipped over. Buildings and trees were also damaged in neighboring Overbrook. In Iowa, a barn was demolished and other buildings damaged after a tornado touched down in Dallas County. National Weather Service reported ping-pong ball-sized hail in Bloomfield. In Missouri, a Chicago-bound plane returned to Kansas City International Airport just before 6 a.m. due to a possible lightning strike. American Airlines spokesperson Gianna Yurgo said in an email, maintenance workers were inspecting the aircraft. Briefly, Menendez. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez, Democrat of New Jersey, may seek exoneration at his May bribery trial by blaming his wife, saying she kept him in the dark about anything that could be illegal about her deals with businessmen, according to court papers unsealed Tuesday. In Ecuador, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro ordered the closure of his country's embassy and consulates in Ecuador on Tuesday over Ecuadorian authorities' raid on the Mexican embassy in Quito. Fentanyl. China is fueling the fentanyl crisis in the U.S. by directly subsidizing the manufacturing of materials traffickers use to make the powerful synthetic drug outside the country, according to a report released Tuesday by a special House panel. In the Middle East, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned Tuesday of potential global economic damage from rising tensions in the Middle East, as the Biden administration said it will impose new sanctions on Iran due to its activity in the region. Project. A federal judge rejected a request Tuesday by Native American tribes and environmentalists to stop work on a $10 billion transmission line being built through southeastern Arizona to carry wind-generated electricity from New Mexico to California. Student debt. The Education Department filed paperwork Tuesday for a proposed new regulation to deliver the student loan debt cancellation President Joe Biden announced last week. It faces a 30-day public comment period and review. Our next story regarding the Trump hush money criminal trial. Headline states, first juror seated in New York. Choosing a jury could take days, proceedings expected to last weeks. Courtesy of Michael Sizak, Jennifer Peltz, Jake Offenhartz, and Alana Durkin-Richter from Associated Press. From New York, the first seven jurors for Donald Trump's hush money trial were seated Tuesday after lawyers grilled the jury pool about their social media posts, political views, and personal lives to decide who can sit in fair judgment of the former president. The jurors include an English teacher, an oncology nurse, and a corporate lawyer. 11 more people still need to be selected before opening statements began in the Manhattan case accusing the Republican of falsifying business records to cover up a sex scandal during his 2016 campaign. On the second day of jury selection, New Yorkers were quizzed for hours about their views on Trump and other issues, and 8 were excused after saying they could not be impartial or because they had other commitments. Several would-be jurors told the judge they believed decide the case fairly, no matter their feelings about Trump or his policies as president. The methodical process could take several more days or even weeks. The trial is expected to last for 6 weeks or more. The trial, which began Monday, puts Trump's legal problems at the center of his closely contested race against President Joe Biden. It's the first of Trump's four criminal cases to go to trial, and it may be the only one to reach a verdict before voters decide in November whether to elect the presumptive GOP presidential nominee. Trump looked on in the courtroom as his lawyers urged the judge to remove one presidential juror for a social media post he had made after his 2020 election loss. Trump, at one point, spoke loudly and gestured while the judge questioned the woman, causing the judge to admonish the former president. "I don't know what he was uttering, but it was audible and he was gesturing, and he was speaking in the direction of the juror," Judge Juan Merchan said. "I won't tolerate that. I won't tolerate any jurors being intimidated in this courtroom." Prosecutor Joshua Steinglass took Trump's notoriety head-on, telling would-be jurors that attorneys would not be looking for people who had been living under a rock for the past 8 years. They just needed to keep an open mind. "This case has nothing to do with your personal politics. It's not a referendum on the Trump presidency or popularity contest or who you're going to vote for in November. We don't care. This case is about whether this man broke the law," he said. From the Middle East, UN chief calls for de-escalation. Pakistan, Saudi Arabia demand ceasefire and aid to Palestinians in Gaza. There's a photo on this article. Wounded Palestinians arrived Tuesday at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah after Israeli bombardment in the Maghazi refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip. From the Associated Press in the United Nations, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for urgent de-escalation of hostilities in a phone conversation with Iran's foreign minister following Tehran's weekend attack on Israel. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric said Tuesday that Guterres also called for a renewed focus on bringing peace to the Middle East. Dujarric said Guterres spoke to Foreign Minister Hossein Amiraboudouabian on Monday. Dujarric said Israel's UN ambassador Gilad Erdan heard his call during an emergency Security Council meeting on Sunday for an immediate cessation of hostilities. Guterres reiterated his condemnation of the attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria's capital, Damascus, on April 1st, which violated the principle of inviolability of diplomatic premises under the Vienna Conventions. The UN Human Rights Office called on Israeli security forces Tuesday to immediately end their active participation in and support for Jewish settlers' attacks on Palestinians in the West Bank. The statement followed a wave of settler attacks on Palestinian towns and villages in the West Bank, triggered by the killing of a 14-year-old Israeli boy in what authorities say was a militant attack. The Palestinian Health Ministry said Israeli forces or settlers killed 7 Palestinians since the attacks began Friday. Another 75 were wounded. The UN also issued an appeal for $2.8 billion to provide aid for 3 million Palestinians, stressing Gaza needs not only food but sanitation, water, and health facilities. Meanwhile, Tuesday, Pakistan and Saudi Arabia called for an immediate ceasefire and uninterrupted delivery of humanitarian aid in Gaza. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan, on a visit to Islamabad, said international efforts towards a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas have been wholly insufficient. "We are now actively discussing the potential for famine in Gaza, and if it means people are starving to death because humanitarian assistance is not getting to them," he said. "This is an unacceptable situation." Pakistan's former minister, Ishaq Dar, described the killings in Gaza as genocide, and there should be an immediate and unconditional ceasefire with aid flowing into the territory. And for our next story, headline reads, GOP sends Mayorkas impeachment to Senate. They claim Homeland Security Secretary was not enforcing the border laws, courtesy of Associated Press. From Washington, the House sent two articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate on Tuesday, forcing a trial on allegations that he has willfully and systematically refused to enforce immigration laws. While the Senate is obligated to hold a trial under the rules of impeachment once the charges are walked across the Capitol, the proceedings may not last long. Democrats are expected to try to dismiss or table the charges this week before the full arguments get underway. As House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, signed the articles Monday in preparation for sending them across the Capitol, he said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, should convene a trial to hold those who engineered this crisis to full account. After Tuesday's ceremonial procession and presentation of the articles, the proceedings will begin Wednesday. The entire process could be done within hours. Majority Democrats have said the GOP case against Mayorkas doesn't rise to the high crimes and misdemeanors laid out as a bar for impeachment in the Constitution. Next article. Johnson pushes ahead on aid package for allies. Facing resistance from in his party, GOP Speaker will need Democrat support. From Washington, House Speaker Mike Johnson pushed back Tuesday against mounting Republican anger over his proposed U.S. aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and other allies, and rejected a call to step aside or risk a vote to oust him from office. "I am not resigning," Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, said after a testy morning meeting of fellow House Republicans at the Capitol. Johnson referred to himself as a wartime Speaker of the House and indicated in his strongest self-defense yet that he would press forward with a U.S. national security aid package, a situation that would force him to rely on Democrats to help him pass it over objections from his weakened majority. "We are simply here trying to do our jobs," Johnson said, calling the motion to oust him absurd and not helpful. Johnson appeared emboldened by his meeting late last week with Donald Trump when the Republican former president threw him a political lifeline with a nod of support after their private talk at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. At his own news conference Tuesday, Johnson spoke of the importance of ensuring Trump is reelected to the White House.
You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 17th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Tom from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833.
Our next story regards the Summer Olympics in Paris. Security, transport issues squeeze opening ceremony. Courtesy of Jerome Pugmire from the Associated Press. In Paris. The talk before the opening ceremony of the Paris Games ideally should be about its grandiose backdrop. The summer sun setting on the Seine River as athletes drift by in boats and wave to cheering crowds. But behind the romantic veneer that Paris has long curated, mounting security concerns have already had an impact on the unprecedented open-air event. In January, the number of spectators allowed to attend the ceremony was slashed from around 600,000 to around 320,000. Tourists were told they won't be allowed to watch it for free from riverbanks because the French government scaled back ambitions amid ongoing security threats. Then, on March 24th, France raised its security readiness to its highest level after a deadly attack at a Russian concert hall and the Islamic State's claim of responsibility. French President Emmanuel Macron said the ceremony could be shifted instead to the national stadium at Stade de France if security threat is deemed too high. Security and transportation are the biggest concerns heading into the Paris Games, which run from July 26th to August 11th. For security, 30,000 police officers are expected to be deployed each day, with 45,000 working the opening ceremony. With its own resources stretched thin, France has asked 46 countries to help provide about 2,200 extra officers, many of whom will be armed. The French Defense Ministry has also asked for foreign nations for a small number of military personnel, including sniffer dogs. Tony Estanguet, the head of the Paris Games Organizing Committee, said there would be unprecedented security measures. "France has never deployed so many means for security," he said. "I have faith that the security services in our country will make the games safe. Cameras will be increased around the city, but facial recognition will not be used." So far, 120 chiefs of state have confirmed that they will attend the opening ceremony. Holding it outside a stadium means greater exposure for athletes paraded on 84 boats along the Seine along a 3.7-mile route towards the Eiffel Tower, with 20,000 people living in apartments having views of the ceremony. Behind multiple security cordons, Paying spectators will watch from the lower embankments, while upper embankments are free for those with invitations. An area around the Seine is expected to be closed to traffic a week before the parade, and airspace will be closed on the night of the ceremony, France's Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said. Swedish swimmer Victor Johansson will not attend the ceremony because it's that day before the free 400-meter freestyle, but it's confirmed, confident, it's safe. I don't have any worries at all, Johansson said. I think they've taken all the precautionary actions to make it safe and fun for everyone involved. For transportation, driving in congested Paris can be hellish at the best of times, let alone during a major international event. Some of the 2.1 million people living within the city limits plan to flee Paris for 2+ weeks while motorists are angered by a proposal that would require them to apply online for a QR code to access traffic-restricted zones. There's also the threat of train strikes to take into account. The CGT Public Servants Union has announced plans to strike during the Olympics, which could mean many transport workers walking out. Transport operators are gearing up to carry between 600,000 to 800,000 Olympic visitors per day. An ad campaign on billboards called Anticipate the Games directs people to tell to a website, instructing them on how to lessen the impact. National rail giant SNCF has blocked sales of tickets for July 26 to and from three major stations all very near the Seine. Gare de Lyon, France's biggest station from its mainline trains, Paris-Bercy, and Austerlitz. Some other smaller stations will also close. Subway tickets will rise from $2.30 to $4.30 for a single ticket, and a book of 10 tickets from $18.30 to $34.60. Tourists opting for a Paris 2024 pass pay $17 per day or $76 weekly, a far cry from the free public transport once envisaged. And an express train running from Paris' main international airport, Charles de Gaulle, to the center of the city in 20 minutes has been shelved until 2027. But a newly extended metro service on Line 14 is expected to be ready in June, carrying people from Paris' second airport, Orly, to an Olympic hub that includes the village, national stadium, and aquatic center. In regards to accommodations, the Olympic Village will house more than 14,000 athletes and officials, with apartments holding a maximum of 8 people. Fans and tourists, however, have been subjected to an increase in hotel and Airbnb prices. The Paris region has France's greatest concentration of hotel accommodation, with 160,000 rooms. Adding rental accommodations, campsites, and other options, the region has around 260,000 rooms for the Olympics. Although some hotels triple prices, competition from Airbnbs forced them to backpedal. Average prices for a one-night stay dropped from about $825 to $565, still far higher than the average price last July of $220. Our next story is a Q&A regarding the internet. All in the label. FCC rule aims to make broadband pricing and fees more transparent. Courtesy of Cora Lewis of the Associated Press. Much like nutritional labels on food products, broadband labels for internet packages will soon tell you just what is going into the pricing of your service, thanks to new rules adopted by the FCC. If you've ever shopped for home or mobile internet, you can understand how hard it can be to understand what you're actually paying for, John Donenberg, Deputy Director of the White House National Economic Council, said on a recent call with reporters. The broadband nutrition label is a tool that can help consumers make sure they have a clear, straightforward explanation of home and mobile services before signing up for anything. Following the design of FDA food labels, these broadband labels will provide easy-to-understand, accurate information about the cost and performance of high-speed internet service to help consumers avoid junk fees, price hikes, and other unexpected costs. Internet service providers selling home access or mobile broadband plans are required to have a label for each plan beginning April 10th. The labels will be mandated to appear at any point of sale, including online and in stores, and they will be required to disclose all pricing information, including introductory rates, data allowances, and speeds. The labels will include links to information about network management practices and privacy policies. Here's what you need to know. What's behind the new labeling? Hidden fees and unexpected rate hikes have dogged consumers shopping for internet service for years, and the Biden administration cracked down on junk fees or opaque and misleading fee structures across industries, including banking, hotel and airline pricing, and utility and phone services for the past several years.
On a call, a spokesperson for the FCC clarified that the labels cannot be buried in multiple clicks or hidden in a way that a consumer might miss. Fees can make it hard to understand the true cost of an internet plan, Dunnenberg said, adding that the agency is committed to rooting out surprise junk fees that some companies pile onto your bills. What information will labels contain? Monthly price and contract length, whether that price will change after a certain period or what it will change to, complete list of monthly and one-time fees and early termination fee, whether the company participates in the Affordable Connectivity Program and link to check if one qualifies, typical download and upload speeds and latency, data cap and price beyond that cap, links to network management, an example given, zero rating and content blocking and privacy policies. A glossary is available to help consumers better understand the information that is displayed on the label. When do these rules take effect? While many providers will begin displaying their labels in April, some firms with less than 100,000 subscribers will have until October 10th to comply with the FCC rules. If a provider does not display their labels or post inaccurate information about its fees or service plans, consumers can file a complaint with the FCC Consumer Complaint Center. Our next story is about business. At the beginning here, it shows Disney's CEO race, and it shows a picture of the entrance to Walt Disney's corporate headquarters in 2021 in Burbank, California. Disney is assessing candidates to take over the storied company should chief executive Bob Iger step down as planned in 2026. This is courtesy of Meg James, Ryan Faulkner, Samantha Masunaga, and Stephen Bellagio from the Los Angeles Times. Walt Disney co-executive Bob Iger has prevailed in the company's shareholder fight against billionaire dissent Nelson Peltz. But the celebrated executive's most challenging task remains, selecting someone to fill his shoes. The 73-year-old chief is set to retire in 2026, assuming he steps down as planned. For decades, succession planning has been among the Burbank giant's most vexing issues. During Iger's first highly successful 15-year run, he delayed his planned retirement multiple times, and potential successors, including former chief operating officer Tom Staggs, left the company in frustration. Peltz and others pointed to the bungled handoff to Parks head Bob Chapek as proof that Disney's board of directors, who oversaw the succession process, weren't up to the job. Chapek's tumultuous tenure lasted less than 3 years. Iger returned in late 2022 to replace him. Succession is the board's number one priority, Iger said during a recent appearance on CNBC. Disney historically promotes from within, but board members are currently looking at potential external candidates as well as four top executives. Disney Entertainment co-chair Dana Walden, who oversees television, fellow entertainment co-chair Alan Bergman, who runs the film studios, Walden and Bergman share oversight of streaming, Parks, Products, and Experiences czar Josh D'Amaro, and ESPN boss James Spataro. Disney's leading contenders have their own areas of expertise as well as blind spots. None has had the experience of running a $220 billion multifaceted media and entertainment empire such as Disney, but then again, neither did Iger before he ascended to the throne in 2005. Our first candidate, Dana Walden, boss of all TV. One of the savviest executives in Hollywood, Dana Walden oversees a vast portfolio of properties and programming crucial to Disney's legacy TV business and its streaming future. She's in charge of Disney's television studios, the ABC Network, ABC News, children's, and young adult programming, Freeform, National Geographic, FX, Hulu, and Hulu Originals. Walden arrived at Disney 5 years ago when the company bought much of Rupert Murdoch's 21st Century Fox. One of Iger's motivations for the deal was to boost Disney's TV executive talent by bringing over successful Fox personnel, including Walden, FX's John Landgraf, and former TV head Peter Rice. The pricey Fox acquisition, while ambassaded by Peltz and others, gave Disney a programming arsenal to support its streaming ambitions. Among the four CEO candidates, Walden may be the most similar to Iger in terms of career trajectory and soft touch with talent. She has deep relationships with, and the respect of, Hollywood's producers, writers, and other talent. She grew up in Studio City and got her start in television as a publicist, including a stint promoting Arsenio Hall. The 59-year-old executive could become Disney's first female CEO. Perhaps the biggest knock on Walden is that she didn't come up through Disney's ranks, leading some in the rank to file to question whether enough Mickey Mouse DNA is present in her cells. She'd also have to overcome the perception that she's just a TV exec. That's not the case, given her streaming purview. Next, Alan Bergman, the non-flashy studio chief. At Disney's core, it all comes back to movies, and it's been that way since Walt and Roy Disney founded their studio in 1923. To this day, theatrical film drives most other parts of the business, including theme park attractions and toy sales. As such, entertainment co-chair Alan Bergman, 58, sits atop an extraordinarily important part of the company, shepherding storied brands including Disney Animation, Pixar, Marvel Studios, Lucasfilm, and Searchlight Pictures, known for recent four-time Oscar winner Poor Things. Bergman is a true Disney veteran with a deep and detailed understanding of business and finance, having joined the company in 1996. He was promoted to president of Walt Disney Studios in 2005 and fully took over the division in 2020, succeeding Alan Horn after a period of unprecedented box office success, including hits such as Avengers Endgame and Star Wars The Force Awakens. He's not flashy. A UCLA graduate in business economics, Bergman has avoided the spotlight, preferring to let his deputies, such as Marvel's Kevin Feige and Disney Animation's Jennifer Leigh, take their due credit. Yet he commands the respect of those high-powered executives and has worked for years with the likes of Peter Jackson, James Cameron, and Ryan Coogler. Efforts are underway to get Disney's all-important theatrical film business back on track. Iger has allowed his division heads, including Bergman, to slow their output and focus on quality over quantity. This year's Disney slate includes a big franchise extensions, Inside Out 2, a Moana sequel, and Mufasa, The Lion King. Next, Jimmy Pitaro, Sports Supreme. When ESPN chair Jimmy Pitaro took over the reins of the sports cable giant in 2018, he inherited a division beset by shrinking TV ratings while cord-cutting was eroding its ability to reach viewers. ESPN's hosts were under fire over the political discourse on its talk shows in the wake of President Donald Trump's 2016 victory. Pitaro, 54, who previously led Disney's consumer products and interactive media division, is credited with calming the waters and preparing the network for the future by increasing its digital prowess and growing its social media presence to keep it relevant to younger viewers. To further that aim, he's overseeing the launch of ESPN's long-awaited direct-to-consumer product, which by fall 2025 will give consumers access to its full suite of channels, including the flagship ESPN. Pitaro is also credited with repairing ESPN's relationship with the NFL, helping to pave the way for a new 11-year media rights deal with the league that gives the company two Super Bowls that will air on Disney's ABC broadcast network. Though Pitaro is well-liked within the company, he'd be a novice in the Hollywood side of the business. But he's comfortable with show business types. His wife, Jean Louisa Kelly, is a veteran film actress. Lastly, Josh D'Amaro, Keeper of the Magic Kingdom. To legions of superfans, the charismatic Josh D'Amaro is Mr. Disney. Since joining the company in 1998 in a position at the Disneyland Resort, D'Amaro has steadily climbed the corporate ladder. Under his leadership, the parks have embarked on major capital projects, including new lands such as Star Wars, Galaxy's Edge, and the Avengers Campus. Today, D'Amaro, 53, serves as chair of Disney Experiences, giving him an expansive portfolio that includes oversight of the company's theme parks, its famed Imagineering division, Disney's cruise line, and its consumer products. Think Baby Yoda dolls and Elsa dresses. In all, D'Amaro is in charge of 180,000 employees, many of whom are unionized or part-time, meaning he's used to leading large teams and widely capital-intensive initiatives. The parks are Disney's biggest profit center, showing he can navigate a massive budget. The quote-unquote experiences segment accounted for 60% of Disney's operating income during the most recent fiscal year. He's in charge of a roughly $60 billion effort to expand Disney's parks, a huge bet on live, in-person entertainment. It's a challenging, multi-pronged job that comes with hazards. D'Amaro recently had to navigate the fallout over Disney's nasty feud with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis over the state's anti-LGBTQ+ legislation and the former Reedy Creek Improvement District. But he's popular with Disney's enthusiastic and demanding fans, which helps. On lighter news, here's today's humor. Thanks for the muscle memory, courtesy of Jerry Zazima of Tribune News Service.
I have always believed that exercise and health food will kill you. This explains why I live in deathly fear of broccoli and don't do anything more strenuous than getting up twice a night to go to the bathroom. But now that I've reached the ripe old age of 70, and that at the urging of my doctor, who takes my health to heart, I have returned to the gym in the first time in more than 6 months. It's been 193 days, team member Kenzie Evans said after I scanned my card at the front desk and told her I hadn't been there in a while. I was in jail for sticking up a gym, I said. Kenzie blanched. Not really, I assured her. I've just been lazy. But I recently turned the big 7-0 and figured it was time to come back. Wow, exclaimed Kenzie, who's 19. You look good, for your age. Looks can be deceiving, I replied, but thanks. Don't feel guilty about being away so long, Kenzie said. There was a guy who hadn't been back for 1,000 days. That's 2 years and 9 months, I calculated. He must have been in pretty bad shape. I think that's why he returned, Kenzie said. We kept his membership open. And he was paying for it, I said. Yeah, it's crazy, said Kenzie. You might as well burn your money. But it's better to burn calories, right? I said. Exactly, said Kenzie's boyfriend, Joe Dramus, who also works at the desk. Is it true, I asked Joe, who's 20, that muscles have memory? Yes, he answered. It's amazing, I said. I can't remember what I had for lunch. My muscles have a better memory than my brain. You can go on a long streak of no workouts, then go back to exercising every day, Joe said. Your muscles remember what your body went through. My body went through the ringer, I remembered. It's a good thing the ringer isn't part of the exercise equipment. All of our equipment is on the floor, said Joe. I don't want to end up on the floor myself, I remarked. You won't, promised Billy Bayman, another employee. You just have to pick up an exercise routine and start going slow. Billy, 24, said he used to weigh 400 pounds. I'm down to 250, he added. I like to think most of it is muscle, but I started coming to the gym a year and a half ago. I lost a lot of weight, and now I feel great. Hey, that rhymes, I exclaimed. When he asked what my goal was in coming to the gym, I said, I don't want to leave in the back of an ambulance. That's a good plan, he said. I want to do cardio exercises, I told Billy. The stationary bike is good for that, he said. I wouldn't be going anywhere, I noted. True, Billy said, but you won't be in traffic either. He also added that weightlifting is also good for the heart. So is red wine, I said. I had a rotator cuff problem, and weight exercises really helped, he said. Didn't rotator cuffs used to be in cars, I wondered. Billy took me over to the weight area and asked, do you want to start with barbells or dumbbells? I'm a dumbbell, I said, so let's do barbells. I lifted the lightest one, 20 pounds, and got limbered up. Then I spent a few minutes on a bike. I barely broke a sweat. I started slowly, I told Billy, Joe, and Kenzie as I was leaving. Bye, said Billy. We'll see you soon, Joe said. And not in 193 days, Kenzie added. I'll be back, I said in my worst Arnold Schwarzenegger voice. My muscles just remembered they could use a rest. Explore the National Agricultural Library, courtesy of Barbara Intermill. As I waited with my cup of tea for a webinar to begin, I jotted down what I knew about our National Agricultural Library. It belongs to Americans, it is related to the science of agriculture, and it's a storehouse of valuable information. I had no idea what that all entails. The USDA National Agricultural Library is one of 5 national libraries in the U.S., and it houses one of the world's largest collections devoted to all the sciences related to farming, forestry, ranching, food quality, and nutrition. It all started in 1862 when President Abraham Lincoln signed the U.S. Department of Agriculture into existence. From there began a collection of all we have learned about food production and nutrition. As the webinar began, USDA experts walked us through the resources, some familiar, some not. Most amazing to me was that all of this reliable information is in one place, and literally at our fingertips. Type in now.usda.gov to get started. Under the Topics tab, choose Human Nutrition and Food Safety. That's where you can browse various resources in detail. Explore the ins and outs of vegetarian eating, for example, or find up-to-date guidance on nutrition for certain health conditions, such as how to eat when diabetes strikes during pregnancy, or how to deal with eating disorders such as anorexia or binge eating. Maybe you just want to know what nutrients are in that avocado you just ate. USDA's Food Data Central is the place to go. It offers nutrient information on 440,000 foods. Or let's say you need a list of foods high in a certain nutrient, such as dietary fiber.
You can do that too. From this same site, you can access nutrition.gov, which pulls together easy-to-understand nutrition based on sound research. For example, you'll find a video about how to separate nutrition facts from fiction. Need more scientific or technical information? Find research from USDA's Agricultural Research Service, usda.ars.gov, on this site as well. This agency's job? To find solutions to agricultural problems that affect Americans every day, from field to table. Need more specific information? Several tools are included to search for what you need. It's like having a trusted librarian right at your side. The National Agricultural Library even offers a collection of resources about the history of agriculture in our country. There's historical data on how dietary guidance has evolved over the years, and documented accounts of how farmers fed our nation during the World Wars. To be sure, there are a lot of voices competing for our attention in the field of nutrition. Be encouraged that these credible resources are based on the most current scientific evidence to date. And yes, I learned. They are updated as new facts become known. Our last story here regards the NBA. James Lakers secure a playoff berth with victory over the Pelicans, courtesy of the Associated Press. From New Orleans, LeBron James, Anthony Davis, and their supporting cast have the Los Angeles Lakers looking like a tougher out in the playoffs than they appeared to be just a few weeks earlier. The New Orleans Pelicans, meanwhile, find themselves on the brink of elimination and wondering about the health of star power forward Zion Williamson, whose dominant NBA postseason debut was cut short of an injury in the final minutes of a tight game. James had 23 points, 9 assists, and 9 rebounds, and the Lakers secured a playoff berth with a 110-106 victory over the New Orleans Pelicans in the Western Conference play-in tournament on Tuesday night. "Tonight we showcased what we were able to do both offensively and defensively," said James, whose team enters the NBA playoffs having won 12 of 15 games. "We've got a good group going right now, good rotation, good plan, and guys are coming in ready to go." Williamson had 40 points and 11 rebounds in his NBA postseason debut, but shortly after tying the game in 95 with a driving layup with 3:19 to go, Williamson went to the locker room, throwing a towel to the floor in disgust as he walked to the tunnel with an apparent injury. After the game, Pelicans coach Willie Green said Williamson had left leg soreness. Davis finished with 20 points and 15 rebounds. Russell scored 21, hitting 5 times from deep. James was 10 of 10 from free throws, and Davis was 8 of 10. The Lakers advanced to face defending NBA championship champion Denver in the first round in a rematch of last season's Western Conference Finals, which was swept by the Nuggets. The Pelicans will get one more chance to advance when they take on the Sacramento Kings on Friday. Speaking of the Kings, Kings 118, Warriors 94. Keegan Murray scored 32 points, De'Aaron Fox added 24, and Sacramento stayed alive in the play-in tournament by eliminating visiting Golden State. The Kings avenged a Game 7 loss at home to the Warriors in last year's first round by playing cleaner and being quicker to loose balls. The loss kept Golden State out of the playoffs for the third time in the past 5 seasons, including 2 eliminations in the play-in tournament. Stephen Curry had 22 points for the Warriors, who committed 16 turnovers. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for April 17th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Tom from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes helped them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies helped them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.